We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Welcome to the True Faith Podcast. Long show today, kind of two podcasts in one for you. My name is Alex Hurst. And first of all, I'm presenting a chat with Colin Whittle of the Newcastle United Supporters Trust about everything that's been going on recently, increased protests towards Mike Ashley on a small scale at the moment, but it looks like it's starting somewhere and it looks like it's going to build with various fan groups getting together. Colin talks through the aims of the trust and why you should join and where he sees Newcastle United going in terms of ownership, protest, the manager, all that kind of stuff. A fascinating chat, thanks to Colin. And after that, we've got a chat from the lads who still are over in Porto. It's Sunday morning here. And I'm sure there's sore heads all around after a day on the Superbug, Chagres, and whatever else they were drinking yesterday. They talk through United's 0-0 draw over there, recorded live from over there. So they'll have a talk through that and where it leaves United in pre-season and where we'll go from here. So thanks very much for tuning into the True Faith Podcast. I'm going to leave you now with my chat with Colin. This podcast is sponsored by our patrons who pay £5 a month for four extra shows a week, and who keep this main podcast free. Thanks to you people. Next Sunday is our great big 2018-19 season preview, so tune into that. That all podcasts now, all free podcasts like that, are recorded on the True Faith YouTube channel. So if you want to see, would rather watch us talk it through in the small studio we've got, please head to True Faith NUFC podcast on YouTube. Subscribe, loads of videos, a twice weekly video called Mag Talk is also up on there, and that'll be from next Sunday. Okay, here's me and Colin. Welcome along to the True Faith Podcast. You've got myself, Alex Hurst, today, and a special guest from the Newcastle United Supporters Trust, Colin Whittle. You are vice chair?
No, I'm just a normal board member.
Just a normal board member.
The trust, yeah.
Sorry, giving you too much of a billing here.
You've elevated.
I wish you'd told us that beforehand. And we're here to talk about, well, this, I suppose you could call this the second podcast, or third, with the one with Steve Wraith. So this is the third about the movement If Rafa Goes, We Go, just trying to get different supporter and key people reactions, Colin. First of all, before we go into details about the history of the trust and more importantly, the future of the trust, your assessment of what's happened over the past kind of 7 to 10 days with the movement coming about online.
Yeah, I think the first thing I had, the observations of the fact that this movement has moved so quickly, it's got so much support, and I think generally what's happened is the supporters have been pushed to the limit over the years, and they find what's happening at the moment totally unacceptable. We've got an owner who doesn't really seem to want to progress the club in any way, whereas we've got a manager who does. And I think this movement kicked off last week, and the amount of traction it's got in such a short period of time, I think it's captured everybody's imagination, and it really has drawn out people from who have been sitting in the past but are now saying, look, enough is enough. And so it's quite interesting. We're due to meet the guys behind it later this week. So I think we've been a bit quiet on social media, etc. lately, because we've been waiting to meet the various fans groups and this new movement, just so that we can coordinate things and work with other fans groups collectively. But it has gained traction in such a short period of time. It's been amazing, to be honest with you.
And obviously that's led to a few different things. You know, there's been a lot of media coverage. The Chronicle have got involved. The Newcastle Central, I think, MP, Gianni Urre, has taken this to Parliament, received both quite a lot of praise and, bizarrely to me, some criticism. And your thoughts on that? And I know Chi's got a bit of a history with the Trust and the club.
Yeah, well, she is a member of the Trust, and she's also spoke at various events that we've had over the years. We've done a couple of events. Whose club is it anyway? Was probably one that's been well received by more than anybody else. We had a supporters representative from Germany coming over talking about the whole way the fans are represented in Germany, and we had members of other supporter trusts around the country speaking. She spoke at that. She's also spoke at various other events, probably most notably over the last years when we were heavily involved in the NUFC Fans Food Bank. She's supporting her local community, I think, is the position. As far as we're concerned, Newcastle is a community club, and we've got an MP in the centre of the city actually standing up for a club in the community. So it's praised by us, to be honest with you. I think there is many other issues, but she's been brave enough to come out and with her petition. So she's got our full support.
Yeah, and it's always interesting to gauge reaction, and social media isn't always a fantastic gauge because, A, there aren't that many Newcastle fans on it in terms of the wider population, although there are quite a lot. It's always strange, I think, to see some criticism of these things. You know, people saying, it's quite vocally on social media, I don't think an MP should get involved. I think there are more important things for them to talk about, and whilst everybody's entitled to their opinion, I'm not saying particularly that makes her right and them wrong. You know, it's almost like you see a lot of people saying, well, you can't target Sports Direct because of the staff. Well, no one's actually talking about targeting or making staff unhappy. Going to the front of the queue has been suggested by the people and not buying something. Worse things will happen. As far as I can remember, though I'm not an expert, the staff at Sports Direct aren't on commission, so it won't affect their livelihood or their income. You can't do that. You can't use your local MP. You can't boycott the game. Do you feel that sometimes there's a little bit of defeatism amongst some supporters, which rubs off on other people and therefore stops anything meaningful happening?
Yeah, I think that's a very good point, actually. I mean, what we've seen over the years when we've been involved in various activities, we've had loads of fans who are not happy with the regime and the way the club's been managed by the owner and wanted action to be taken, but there's always been a disconnect on the type of action that should be taken. And a lot of people want one thing to happen and they don't agree with something else happening. Other people have got a different view, and it's almost impossible for, you know, we've got 52,000 to go at the match, but the support is much larger than that. It's almost impossible for everybody to agree on one particular thing. So I think it's a question of getting a middle ground. I mean, from our perspective, we've been involved in quite a lot of activities over the years, whether it be marches, rallies, other sorts of boycotts. And what we've found is that loads of people have supported them in the media, et cetera, but there's been a large amount of people who just basically haven't been prepared to take action, and which is disappointing because it's only with the numbers do you then get the subsequent publicity. And we accept that it's impossible for everybody to agree on everything. But I think if we want to take something that will change and make a change at Newcastle and change the owner, it's something that has to happen collectively from the fans together. And sometimes you mightn't necessarily agree on the proposed course of action. But I think if we're all working together, then that's the only way forward. As far as the Trust were concerned, we were involved in a number of matters over the years, a number of initiatives over the years. And in general, we've found that although a lot of people have indicated they'll give support, they'll turn up at events, that hasn't actually materialised. And we sort of took a position a couple of years ago that clearly we weren't getting the numbers for initiatives that we were proposing, despite the fact that fans were wanting change. So we've been working on a national basis with National Supporters Organisations, FSF, Supporters Direct, and that's been with a view to influencing the wider change in football, whether it be legislative change at the FA, in order that you can have fan representation imposed upon clubs, because clubs and owners aren't willing, we don't think, to accept change and accept supporter representation. And I think there comes a point where it either has to be forced by action or alternatively by legislative or change at the highest level by the decision makers within the game.
So just can I quickly get your position? I've probably got ahead of myself here. In the Trust's opinion, why does Newcastle United and the Newcastle United fan base have to, at this moment in time, seek to try and force a change of ownership?
I think we're in a position at the moment where we've got an owner who really isn't interested in the progress of Newcastle United. The infrastructure, such as training facilities, etc., they're not being progressed. The first team, you know, that you've got a manager there who you just look at his credentials. He's as good a manager as you can ever get. He's not being supported. I think we're at an important point within the history. We've had two relegations under the present owner, and we've been lucky enough on both occasions to come back. My worry is that we go and get relegated a third time. That could be it. There may well be no coming back. The manager will certainly be away, and you know, he's got a year's left on his contract, and as best we understand, he's going to stick to that. But you know, the football is littered with history of big clubs who were big clubs, and unfortunately, they're now languishing in lower divisions. Our neighbours, look where they're at the moment, and there's big clubs with big history who in the past have made bad decisions, which have led to them being where they are now. And you know, you fear that could happen to us. We've actually got a great opportunity to push on under this manager with some investment, with some support for the manager and who he wants to bring in. We finished 10th last season, and I think where the manager wants to do is look to improve again, but the squad seems to not be improving, weakened if anything, and you then get you get dragged into a struggle with all the other clubs. I mean, look at the teams who got relegated last season. You know, you're talking teams who had historically been mid-placed. And the problem is, if the limit of your ambition is to avoid relegation, one day the trapdoor is going to fall. We've seen that twice already during the current owner's tenure. And I think we can't afford a third. And I think that's at risk at the moment.
The Supporters Trust, was it... Well, you tell me about the formation of it. And I think there's a lot of misconceptions and potentially just some people telling lies about the early days of the trust and what went on. So do you want to, you know, give the listeners, here's the opportunity for you to the listeners to set the record straight.
Yeah, well, the Supporters Trust officially was formed in 2009. Supporters Trust movement has been going since 1999, around 1999, 2000, when it was originally kicked off. I was involved at that point in time because I'd actually been a litigant in the Save Our Seats a case that when the club brought in the corporate level at the Millburn. And what happened, I was approached because I was a litigant in those proceedings by people involved in Supporters Direct, asked whether or not I was prepared to get involved in the wider Supporters Trust movement. And at that point in time, we actually put... we were a small shareholder in what was the PLC, so we got 100 small shareholders together to sign a motion that would set up a Supporters Trust at Newcastle. This was in the early 2000s. We met with a finance director at the club. He approved the motion that we were putting there. I won't go into the details, but the owners backed it, didn't back it. It disappeared at that point in time. The motion got rejected. We were PLC at the time. And then when under the current owner, when Keegan was sacked, obviously there was a lot of dissension amongst the supporters. A fans group, Newcastle United Supporters Club, was set up at that point in time, and that was during the season that we first got relegated. Unfortunately, as you know, we were unable to stay in the division at that Premier League at that particular time. And during the course of the summer following our relegation, we were approached once again by Supporters Direct and talked about, look, you really need to set up a Supporters Trust at Newcastle, link it to the National Supporters Trust movement. A lot of the work that was going on was about recognising Supporters Trusts as the group that supporters, that owners should have links with in their clubs. So as a result of that, there was a couple of meetings with representatives from Supporters Direct. I think in the town, we'd had James Matthew, who was the representative of Supporters Direct at that point in time, who come and give a talk. We had guys from Man United Supporters Trust who attended. A motion was put to the meeting of the then Supporters Club and said, should we move to Supporters Trust status to give this different status to the club? The position with the Supporters Trust is that you have a board, but you also have rotational board members. People can stand for the committee every couple of years. If they want to see change, they can shape that change by putting themselves forward, coming onto the board. Our current chairman, Peter Fanning, he put himself forward a couple of years ago. He didn't even know any members of the board at all. He was elected onto the board. Now he's the NUST chairman. So it's open to people who want to make change. It's interesting because a lot of people have said to us over the years, we'd join you, but you don't do A, B, C, and D. And I say to people, well, join and make us do A, B, C, and D. Get yourself on the board. Influence change. The board has changed over the last couple of years. We've got a lot of newer board members who are representing across from different areas of the supporters spectrum. And I think from our perspective, it then gives the opportunity to shape the direction of supporter representation going forward. I think, as I've mentioned earlier, we were involved in a lot of activities earlier on. There's various groups sprung up that we supported who were doing marches, rallies, open top bus, etc. We give support to a lot of those initiatives, but I think it split the fan base in some areas where people were arguing you should do this, you shouldn't do that, you shouldn't do the other. And since then, we've sort of concentrated quite a lot on working with the national supporters organisations to influence change. If change isn't going to come locally from supporters, then let's make it nationally by linking in with the wider supporter fan base in the whole country. What has been interesting over the last week is, personally, it's made me think, because I think from thinking there was a little bit of indifference out there, I think it's proved that that isn't the case, and that people have had enough and they want to take some sort of action and that they want change. Of course, any change, you need a new owner you need two things. You need an owner who's going to sell, and you need people who are going to come in and take over. From our perspective, we've released a document a couple of years ago when we did it, the last Whose Club Is It conference, whereby we talked about Newcastle as a community club. That's available to see on our website, nufctrust.co.uk. And it's about how we believe Newcastle should be at the centre of its local community with fans represented. Hopefully change will come. We don't know how long that will be, but we've certainly been in contact with many people over the years who are interested in putting consortiums together. The price has always been a factor that stopped people. We've engaged with accountants and solicitors who are based in national and international firms who've all give their work pro bono, basically because they're Newcastle fans. We've drawn up lists of high wealth individuals who've been approached about putting consortiums together. So from our perspective, it's not for the want of trying. But I think one of the issues that we keep coming back to is that the price that the owner wants to sell at is not a price that people want to pay. And we've probably seen that as recently as the back end of last year with the Amanda Staveley bid, where I know the owner was, there's been a bit of PR about that. But, you know, offers were put in, which after due diligence, the purchasers thought were reasonable offers, and they were rejected. I'm sure there'll be interest still out there. Newcastle, after all, is an attractive club. We've got a regular 52,000 fan base at the games. We've got, you know, stadium based in the centre of the city. We've got opportunities for growth. And we believe that, you know, we should be doing better than we are, and that we could be an owner who really wanted to take the club forward. And we just don't see that this owner wants to take the club forward, and that the club is effectively being used to promote his own retail industry, or his retail interests, and not the club's interests.
That was a very good answer. One of the things I often see on social media is, why hasn't the Trust ever tried to just buy out Ashley? You know, with the fans, I had someone tweet me before saying, you know, all you need is 150,000 Newcastle fans to pay $2,500 each. I suppose we'll come on to that in a moment, but I believe there was serious efforts made in the early days to try and, I don't know, source fund, whatever, a buyout. Do you want to go into any of those details?
Yeah, no problem. I think there's at least two, certainly during the period I've been closely involved, there's been at least two bids where the Trust have been part of a wider consortium where our representatives have actually been in discussion with the club officials with regard to consortiums that have been put forward. So that was individuals or groups of individuals who have come with the idea of purchasing the club who approached us. separately from that, we've done a lot of work with, as I say, international and national accountants and solicitors to come up with alternative options whereby you could have a supporter buyout at the price that's being charged or being requested at the moment. It's a lot different to where we were 7, 8, 9 years ago when it was probably a viable product. We went to the point whereby we engaged. When I say engaged, you did the work for nothing. We had a guy who basically does buyouts who was working and coordinating with solicitors and accountants, putting prospectus together. Problem that you've got behind all of those things is that you still need the funds to get to the point where you're putting a bid together, and that costs money to begin with. So you've got a number of issues that you need to get over. We did some surveys to see what sort of donations and contributions people were prepared to make, and we thought at one point in time that it was a viable proposition. I think at the moment what the owner is probably wanting to accept as a price to sell at, my own view, and I'm not a total expert in this area, and our experts would advise accordingly, is that probably you wouldn't be able to make a complete buyout. You'd need to come together with a wider consortium. There's any number of people have been approached, and as I say, we've been involved with two where we've actually been round the table having discussions with club officials. It's really frustrating, to be honest with you, because one of the things that you want to do is to talk about it, but obviously anybody who's doing anything gets you to sign up to a confidentiality agreement and non-disclosure agreements. So you're sitting where with the knowledge that you've actually had meetings, and I think the people who have been trust board members over the years who are probably listening to it, who've actually been in those meetings, and they can vouch for that. But because we've signed non-disclosure agreements, we've not even been able to talk about it as to who they were, what the structure of bids would be. So it's not that we haven't been doing anything. We've been going around to other clubs, community-owned clubs at lower levels, and looking at how they put these bids together. And we've also looked extensively at structures in Germany, but that's a totally different animal altogether. Where and this is the bit where I was talking about you need legislative change. Where in Germany, you know, there is this 51% rule about fan ownership, and it's enshrined in their rules, and that makes clubs at the hub of their own community, and sponsors want to get involved because you get big local organisations involved. The German model works very well, but you probably need legislative change to bring that about in the UK. We don't think those who run football are quite ready for such a change, but I think it'll happen at some point in time. And obviously the money that's pouring into the game at the moment through Sky makes football very attractive for anybody who wants to get involved. Sometimes, however, it's the wrong people who want to get involved ownership-wise, and perhaps the tests need to be changed by the FA. But we have been undertaking a lot of work, and the frustrating thing about it is that, you know, you can't say a lot about it at the time. Probably we've never promoted it enough as well, because we think there's some things that have come up over the last week where people have said to me, well, why haven't the trust done this? Why haven't the trust done that? And I've actually sat with them and said, oh, we have done this, we have done that. And I've sat and explained with them. We try to avoid social media war. We'd rather sit with people and explain to them some of the things that's happening. We've done that quite regularly over the last couple of years where people have come with questions, queries, and asked about things that we've done, and we've just went for a pint with them or in a coffee shop or met them somewhere which mutually exclusive and sat down and explained some of the things that we've been doing. But we probably haven't got out there in social media and the wider fan base some of the things that we've been doing over the years, which I fully accept we should have been doing better, to be honest with you.
So can you answer the question, why don't you just get the money together? Tell the listeners why it's impossible in 2018 to just get the fans together. So listen, you want rid of Mike Ashley, this is how much we need off you, let's just get it done.
I think there's all sorts of financial rules and regulations behind it to begin with, and it's about how you would hold the money, putting a bid together, how the structure would hold all work, and I think it's a lot of the administrative bureaucratic matters that sit behind that. So I think if you had enough people who were prepared to do that to begin with, and to make a declaration and say they were prepared to put money in a pot. I think then that would be the starting point. What we have done over the last few years, we did an end of season survey to see what the flavour was for that sort of thing. And we found that when we conducted that survey, there probably wasn't sufficient support to enable a supporter buyout. If that changes, we're prepared to take the documentation that we've had prepared over the years, get the solicitors and accountants engaged again and look at it. I think the first thing is we would have to be able to accept, and supporters would have to accept, that you have to have a lump sum to begin with to even put a perspective and a formal bid together, engaging professionals where it's appropriate. So I think it can be done, but it's a long, complicated process, and it certainly isn't as easy as people might think, which is I'll give you X pounds, and if 100,000 people give X pounds, we'll immediately be able to buy the club. You've got to have structures in place for the decision-making thereafter. And we've went down that road. We've produced a lot of stuff that would take us to that point, but the reason why we haven't went any further at this point was because what we don't want to do is to say to people, give us your money until such time as, one, you've got a willing buyer, but two, that you've got structures in place that can seamlessly be put in place if a willing buyer is then willing to sell to the fans. But it is complicated. It's a lot more than simply saying, I'll put X pounds in a pot. I wish it was as easy as that, to be honest with you. And maybe we would have seen a change of owner over the years.
Well, like you say, it's more likely to happen as part of a consortium, because the figures we're talking about, if you say that the club retained its Premier League status and Ashley was willing to accept maybe £340 million. You know, first of all, you've got, what, 52,000 paying customers at Newcastle United. Well, less than that because of waste. So 49,000, how many of them are kids? Yeah. How many of them go but aren't that interested? How many of them go because work pays for their tickets? Not very many, but some. Yeah. So you're really looking about, in my opinion, a hardcore of 30,000 plus maybe some expats. And the figures are fantasy. People don't have this kind of money sitting in the bank to be able to buy Mike Ashley out in Newcastle United.
I think that's a very fair assessment. I mean, we're going through an economic downturn as well. And, you know, whilst the thought of being able to say, I'll give you X pounds, in reality, I don't think at the moment you'll be able to drive sufficient funds to be able to complete a fans buyout. I do think with the consortium is the way to do it. And, you know, people, there's no doubt people have been interested over the years. But I suppose I come back to the rich people do not get rich by paying over the odds for things. And whilst the owner wants reputedly 400 million, we don't know what he wants actually. I mean, that figure's changed certainly from when we sat round the table with the owner's representatives. I think the problem at the moment is being able to get sufficient funds together from a supporter base that would generate enough, and I don't think that's possible without a wider consortium being involved. We have had people who've been interested, and obviously I can't name names, and there is various things that have went on over the years, just hasn't come off so far. But I don't discount that it will happen at some point in time. And from our perspective, we're keen to link with anybody, because we think that no matter who comes in to buy the club, whether it be a consortium, selection of individuals, a multi-billion foreign investor, we still believe that, you know, we would like to see Newcastle as a club that's at the centre of the community, that is being thought of as an owner who wants to come in and progress the club, not an owner who's going to come in and take over the club for their own purposes. And when I say own purposes, you know, I'm looking to talk about generating the other interests, not improving the lot of the club and the local community in the city in which we're all based.
So we've talked about what you think will happen but isn't realistic in the short term. What is realistic for fans? In the trust's opinion, what can fans do to enforce change? And I imagine the first thing you're going to say is join the Newcastle United Supporters Trust.
Well, I think one of the things that you would always say to people is, you know, the stronger your supporter representation, your stronger your supporter organisation, the more sway you've got with anybody, whether it be club or other stakeholders that you're speaking to, because the less members you've got, the easier it is for an external stakeholder, the club or whoever, to say, well, you're not representative. So I think that's the first point, although we would say that we're supporters and you should always engage with your supporters no matter what. And so that's the starting point. So I think the first point is we would look to see if people would join up. But the second point, I think, with regard to action, is to be able to see, bring the various supporters groups together. And I think our supporters groups slightly different in the sense that we're about fan ownership, fan representation. Other groups have got different aims, but I think the common thing is that we all have a love for Newcastle United. So bringing together all the different groups that we know are out there and agreeing a common course of action that everybody can buy into and then can promote to the wider fan base. I mean, I think the last week has certainly shown that people, off supporters in general, are just saying, look, we've had enough. We've got this great opportunity with a manager whose track record speaks for itself. If you support him, and this is what the message is to the owner, if you support that manager, then he will bring in the goods. He will be able to progress Newcastle United both on and off the pitch. I mean, if we look at the things that he's done, even in his short tenure, he's done that. We think he's brought the club and the community together a lot. And look what he's done on the football field. Massive improvements. And I think that can only improve. I think we've got the best manager. You know, we haven't had many great managers. But you look at Bobby Robson, Kevin Keegan in our recent era. And Rafa's certainly up there. But you look at his record, where he's done it in different countries. And he's done it domestically. He's won trophies everywhere he's went. And to some extent, I sit back and think, How's this guy managing our club with what we've gone through over the last 10 years and you know, the two relegations, etc. And you look at us and you think, we've got a guy here who can really take the club forward if he's backed. And I think we shouldn't lose that opportunity. And I think the support during the course of this season will be 100% behind Rafa. But I think if the fans come together, and as I say, we've got a wider fans group meeting lined up, and we're also separately meeting the new fans movement over the next few days, and hopefully supporters together will come up with a combined plan that we can then, the wider fan base will buy into.
And how do people go about getting involved in the trust? What can they do?
With regard to the trust, we've got a website, nufctrust.co.uk. If people put in queries, they want to find out more, you can go onto the site. There's an information email there, info@nust.org.uk. Contact that address. We've also got a Twitter handle, NUFC Trust. If you can communicate with us via those methods, we can provide more information. Our membership actually has grown quite a bit over the last 3 or 4 days. And those are the main forms of contact. We're happy to sit and talk to people who are interested in joining us. As I say, I personally prefer talking to people face-to-face than dealing with social media and Twitter, Facebook or whatever. I think it's much easier just to chat with somebody around the table and tell them what your aims and objectives are. Show them some of the things that you've done over the years and see that you know, we're looking we're fans of the club, and all that we're doing is looking for a better Newcastle United, which I think everybody is.
Okay, Colin, that's brilliant. Thanks for coming out all the way to sunny Northumberland to get this message across to the listeners.
Thank you. It's been an absolute pleasure. It's lovely out there today, and it's been a pleasure to speak to the podcast. Thanks a lot.
Hello, you're listening to the True Faith Match Review. We're recording live from Porto. We've just come out the Estadio do Dragão to see Rafa's Mags draw 0-0 with a very strong-looking Porto side. I'm joined by Mr. Norman Riley and Rob Clothier. Hello, lads.
Hello, you all right?
How was your Porto experience? How was that game for you?
Very good. Fantastic stadium. Their fans were pretty good, weren't they? I thought, you know.
The fans were decent. They did a weird thing with the mobile phones for a bit.
A bit of a Coldplay concert going on there for a minute.
There's a few firecrackers went off as well.
But they had the flags waving in one of the ends.
Good display. I mean, there's a lovely video. In memory of
That was good.
Bobby Robson at the start, which he got a great reception from both sets of fans. Both teams held up a huge banner in memory of him as well. It was just a lovely moment. Mm-hmm. It was a great moment. It was a very, I think both, there was just a good vibe in the stadium. Although negative for us is that all the Newcastle fans were sort of caged behind what seemed to be like a fishing net. So that was a bit weird. So I never really saw. Didn't really get like an HD experience, did we?
Not quite, no. It was a big net hanging in front of us.
Norman, how did you find the atmosphere?
Enjoyed it. Brilliant stadium. Porto fans, very noisy. The kind of ultras, then, I suppose you would call it, that shows us what we ought to have in the UK, in England. English football is so ridiculously sanitised now, the fact you can't even have a flagpole during the match is pathetic, and also you would get idiots whinging that there was a flag in front of them. But it's not like it's constant for 90 minutes, it's almost like every sort of 50 minutes they'll just have a particular song that'll kick it off and the flags will come out, a massive firebomb will go off, and it just creates a really good atmosphere.
That was a really satisfying noise then.
Brilliant. It was absolutely brilliant. I thought it was just excellent. It's one of those where, you know, like you, I think a couple of lads in the Gallagher they tried to bring a drum in, and they've had pellets thrown at them by people who for some reason think there's like, you know, something hideously wrong with the drum. I mean, for me, it contributes to the atmosphere, and we saw the Porto fans. It was great, and the stadium itself is, I mean, from an aesthetic point of view, it's staggering.
It's actually, from the outside, it doesn't look as, it's, you don't realise how deep it goes, mm-hmm. sort of like on underground, sort of on a hill.
Building in the hillside, isn't it? Yeah, so one end's very, very.
But it was absolutely lush. It looked fantastic. So we obviously started with a fairly strong side. Clark was in. We're hearing news that Lejeune might be out for a fair while, which is a massive blow to us. Jacob Murphy got a start on the left hand side. Hosselu and Perez up front. It was I think it was quite significant that Gale didn't make it in the starting lineup, or he didn't make it on the pitch at all. Obviously, before the game, we learned that Mitrovic was flying back to London to agree terms with Fulham after what believes to be a £22 million bid being accepted. It sounds like, or it feels like, Gale's possibly on his way to West Brom. The fact that he didn't feature at all in that game, I think, says a lot. Yedlin was in, Dunn had a half. And, I mean, from that first half, Porto created most of the chances, I thought. They overlapped quite well. The right back seemed to be busy. And we had Martin Dubravka back in goal, and I thought he was absolutely outstanding today. He got loads of chance, and rightly so. He made some absolutely world-class saves. And he just, you know, the organisation that he brings and the stability that he brings to that defence, he's just a reliable guy. He's a The cliched safe pair of hands, but he really is. It makes such a difference to our defending. Yeah. And basically, we were pegged back for most of that first half. And I think we didn't give them too many clear cut chances in the first half. We limited them to a few half chances. We held our shape really well, I think, in the first half. And it took until towards the end of the first half that we slowly started to grow into it. I thought Diarmi had a really, really good game in the middle. I think he kind of outshone Shelvey tonight. I don't know what your lads' views on that one.
Yeah, his work rate was excellent, wasn't it? He was winning possession back. His passing was good as well, I thought. You know, it's not something he's always lauded for, but he was doing very well there. And I think you're probably right, he did probably play better than Shelvey, even though Shelvey had a decent game as well, didn't he? But Diarmi was excellent in the middle.
Like. We chatted before the start of the game about Jacob Murphy getting a start. How did you rate his performance?
I'll tell you what, I would comment on the Shelvey Diarmi.
Sorry,
I don't think we can see Diarmi in a better game than Shelvey, in the sense that they're both playing different roles.
That's true.
Mm-hmm. I thought Diarmi was excellent in the role that he has, and as you see, Robbie's passing was superb. Yep. Tonight. Shelvey did what Shelvey does, and he put some fantastic kind of long range passing in. Shelvey probably played the match more like it was a friendly than Diarmi. Diarmi seemed to play it more like a kind of important competitive match, and that's not a reflection on Shelvey lacking the willing to take it seriously. It's just a case of, well, you know, on a subconscious level, he probably did just kind of slip into that kind of casual mode, whereas Diarmi is a high energy player, and that came across.
Saying that, Shelvey did put a couple of tasty tackles in there, didn't he?
He did. They were training ground tackles.
He caught a guy, didn't he? Was for a little bit. But I thought Lascelles, absolutely excellent.
He's just getting older. Lascelles is getting older. He's got a full season of the Premier League under his belt. He's taken the role of captain, and he's just grown into it every time you see him. And this is a player who, given another season at Newcastle under Rafa, he's just going to get better and better. And if he has a season like he did last year, given it'll be second full season in the Premier League, the season he got relegated, he was kind of in and out of the team under McLaren, he'd be called up to the England squad, I don't doubt it. But on Murphy, I thought maybe he was buzzing.
He was positive.
He was, but the only thing I think with Murphy is he looks very one-footed to me. And that's the only kind of criticism you could level at him. But like you say, he was very positive. And again, I think we spoke about this in the kind of match day podcast that we did. He's the kind of player who, given his age, he's going to be so useful to bring off the bench. He was good last season when he came off the bench, and he was good when he started a couple of games, because he is direct and he does kind of fluster teams. But again, it's one of those where he's got another season on his belt. He needs to start putting on a bit of muscle, I think, because he's very slight at the moment. And he puts on muscle, it'll probably make him a little bit quicker and a bit even more direct. But I think this season for him, it could be very important for him. If he doesn't feature much in the side next season, I would think that his Newcastle career is probably not going to take off. So I think we'll see before Christmas, if he's got like a kind of handful of games on his belt, then maybe he's going to become the player that I probably think we all think he can be.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting you mentioned his physicality there, because I think Jose Perez is a player who came to Newcastle as a quite slight, but he's starting to learn to use his physicality in a really positive way, and sort of he behaves stronger than he actually looks.
He was brilliant Perez tonight,
by the way. Yeah, he really was.
He's
intelligent. So I was Tosloo chased down a bit. I mean, he had one half chance where the left back or the left winger sort of crazily tried to pass it back to the goalkeeper from sort of out wide, which is. And I just think maybe somebody a bit sharper nicks in there and puts them 1-0 up. But we didn't really have too many chances. We had a couple of corners in the first half, but I think Porto kind of went in at half time fairly on top. I think second half, I expected a flurry of changes, to be honest, but I think beyond Manquillo on for Dummett, and obviously Dummett's sort of coming back from being on the treatment table a little bit, we kept with that same team that started for another 10 minutes, which I thought was quite positive.
I think what Rafa's doing is he's more or less starting 11 match fit, isn't he? That's what it is. It's great. I need to phase them into playing basically 80 odd minutes, and I think against Braga, if the wholesale changes, then he'd probably play them again for sort of 60, 65 minutes. Augsburg's the big one. He's probably going to play a full strength side in that game, I would say, for at least the first half. And again, I suppose it also probably reflects on the fact that strength and depth, we're not really kind of squad at the moment that can switch 11 for 11. You know, you saw Longstaff come on, you saw Armstrong come on, I think Sterry came on, didn't he, as well?
Callum Roberts was playing left wing.
Yeah, exactly.
Whether he'd be playing left back. So, I mean, we finished the game with a front four.
That 23 team almost as well.
Front four of basically Longstaff in the hole, in the Perez role. You had Armstrong up front, you had Callum Roberts on the left wing, and then you had Atsu on the right wing. So it was you know what, Hayden came on, Sterry came on,
Shaw came on,
yeah. Darlow came on. So there's a lot of wholesale changes in the second half, and I thought on the Porto side, Abubakar looked a bit of a handful.
Brilliant.
But Yassin Brahimi ran the show for me. He was absolutely everywhere, really tricky little player. He's great. He's a great little playmaker. I think most sides would
walk into our team. I'll tell you, I was impressed with when he came on. I thought Keane was.
Yeah, I was thinking that as well. He was winning possession, wasn't he? And not just winning possession, but when he was winning possession, it was almost like a turnover in basketball. He was getting the ball forward as soon as he won the ball, and I think that's going to be important for us.
Energy and strength, and he's physically, he's very imposing. You don't kind of think, because I mean, we all probably have a kind of idea, or like an almost generalised idea of Japanese and South Korean national sides. It's like the high energy, you know, they're quick on the break. You don't expect them to be particularly physical, but Key almost goes against the grain because he's a big, powerful lad. And physically, he actually looked, he's got the same kind of strength as and the kind of leg power as Dion.
He had a presence about him, definitely.
Yeah, I was really impressed with his vision, like you know, a few of those sprayed passes, and it just
experience made, isn't it?
Yeah. He's very aware of his defensive duties as well. Yeah, like, by the looks of it,
he's got nice touch. His technique's very close. Is that control? And it's another player. He's another player who can proper spray the ball. If Shelby's not going to be on the pitch, Marino had it to an extent, but there's another player now that if Shelby's not going to be on the pitch, we have a player who can still take up that mantle, not quite to the effect that Shelby can manage it, but you know, near enough, and I think that's quite important.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I think as the game progressed, Porto had, I mean, Porto had so many chances. Dubravka made a load of
one of the saves that he made was, I mean, it was, put it this way, if I, part of me doesn't want to see it again because it might actually be as good as what it looked when we saw it live. It was, it looked utterly incredible. It's one of those saves where if he managed to push it around the post, it would have been world class, but he actually managed to catch it in that place,
I think it was a diving header from, yeah. I mean, they were getting in behind quite a lot and really turning the screw on. But I mean, Newcastle, to their credit, as much as we probably weren't getting the ball in the fight, you know, in their defensive third too much in the second half, we held our own defensively, although I think we allowed them more clear-cut chances than we had in the first half, and maybe that's a mixture of maybe fatigue, maybe it's the turnover of substitutes in the second half, or maybe it's just the fact that Porto has won the Portuguese league and we're essentially a championship outfit trying to struggle on. And ultimately, they're a good European side.
They were bringing on players who are internationals. They were bringing players on internationals. We were bringing on basically under 23 players who haven't really played for the first team.
Absolutely.
And we still got another draw against them. And again, it was, yes, Porto had a lot of the ball. And I think I kept turning around to John every 5 minutes and saying, Porto are going to score in the next 5 minutes because they did put that much pressure on. But again, what it highlights is that you've got a Newcastle United managed by Rafa Benitez, a very kind of small core of real quality players. But what he does is he gives the players instructions and they follow them. And we're playing away. I know it's a friendly, but it was a sold-out stadium. They've just presented all our players. This is a big thing that they do every pre-season. They're the champions of Portugal. They'll be in the Champions League. They'll probably get to the second or the quarter rounds of the Champions League. And we put out in the second half a more or less scratch side. And through kind of tactical management and determination, we still drew nil-nil with Porto. I mean, that to me is a good sign for, you know, the start of the season.
It really is. You know, unbeaten pre-season so far. I thought their club song was really catchy. I mean, that would kind of do well in Eurovision.
Yeah, it was beautiful. The whole stadium was fantastic. The whole atmosphere that they generated was fantastic. And also, the other thing I'll say is meeting the fans outside the stadium on the way to the ground. They were just brilliant. It was just a brilliant, brilliant atmosphere. You know, we walked past the bar and some of the fans tried to drag away. We just didn't have time because we were so close to kickoff.
Their instinct was come in for a drink.
Not like what you're doing outside our pub on our street, you know. Like, they were welcoming. Like,
it was almost like they were proud to kind of host us. It was the hospitality there, and it's kind of what, you know, it's what we saw in the bars that we visited. You know, there was a really welcoming atmosphere that people didn't look down on us because we had the black and white stripes on. It was kind of like you've come all the way to our club. It was great. I've had such a good day. It's just been good vibes. Newcastle fans were in full voice, didn't stop singing really. And I mean, I don't know how many was there. Maybe
we guessed about 400 or 500.
And obviously, you don't know how loud that was in the opposite end of the stadium because you're obviously in.
No, I'll tell you how loud it was. As an indicator, I'll tell you what's indicative of it. So in the first half, singing the Dubravka song when he was walking the end of the stadium, he heard that and he turned and he applauded. But when he went off, and as he walked towards the dugouts, everyone was singing, and Dubravka always acknowledges fans when they sing, and he didn't this time. And that to me meant because he came up in the second half, didn't he? Came off in the second half, he came from the opposite end of the pitch, went to the touchline, and we were all singing, "Oh, Martin Dubravka," and he didn't acknowledge it, and that to me suggests that he couldn't hear it from that.
So you think maybe it's sort of Porto fans at the opposite diagonal end. Probably just saw us on, we're just basically watching us on mute. And I was just thinking, shit atmosphere these lads. Like, they're not bringing any game.
To be fair though, that was their end with the flags. It's like the ultras end, isn't it? Exactly. So they'll be the ones creating the noise in the stadium. So at that end, you know,
probably. You wouldn't hear the thing, would you? No.
But I think, like you say, it's for match fitness, and we saw some hard work from the training ground there with the organisation and that defensive organisation. Norman, you mentioned when we came out, you know, about that very Rafa performance. I mentioned, you know, the infamous Man City game when we lost 1-0, but we got men behind the ball. Rafa's ability to organise against a greater attacking threat is something that's going to turn defeats into draws this season, and it's going to help confidence. It's going to get points on the board, and that's good. It's that kind of tactical management that's going to put him. I don't care that a lot of other clubs are spending 20 million this, 30 million that, because ultimately
none of them have Rafa Benitez as manager. Yeah,
exactly.
He's worth more than he. Like, Wolves have gone out and spent a load of money on these brilliant Portuguese players, don't get me wrong, but Espírito Santo isn't Rafa Benitez. You've got Fulham going out and spend their money. You can't have just Benitez. You've got Brighton, Huddersfield, Houghton and Wagner aren't Rafa Benitez. So they haven't to spend 50, 60, 70, 80 million more than
just
us
to get on the par.
Let's put either McLaren or Pardew into the dugout tonight, right? Utterly fucking inept and clueless. This is the difference. Pardew and McLaren, are two most recent managers apart from Carver. We'll leave that because he wasn't a manager, was he? They have nothing beyond this kind of one or two dimensional tactical fucking, tactical fail they've got. That's all they've got. They've got like, this is what I do and that's it. They won't even think about the opposition. Don't even think. This is how they play. This is their squad. It's better than Moore's, right? This is what we've got. Now, how am I going to get the best out of my team against this superior side? This is what I've got to do. That's what Rafa does all the time. McLaren and Pardew tonight against our Porto side, you'd be looking at a 3 or 4 pacing. And the thing is, it would only be 3 or 4 because they would have slowed down after the first 20 minutes because they'd already be 2 up. That's the difference.
Yeah, absolutely.
Rafa's worth probably 20 points a season just based on his tactical capacity alone.
Absolutely. I can't disagree. Like you say with McLaren, the likes of McLaren and Pardew, dummies guide to Premier League survival. They're just chapter one. That's how it is.
Yeah.
Rafa adapts to every single game based on intense research, based on his tactical, malleability.
And also during the match as well. That's the thing. He can affect change within minutes. I mean, I'm waxing lyrical here, and I'll stop in a second. But what he does is, so he look at an opposition and go, right, this is how they're going to play. They're a superior side, they've got superior players in this position, so this is what we need to do. This is what we're going to do. Drill the players before the match, for the week leading up to the match, or whatever it is, and they'll start the match. Now, if they start getting on top, or they maybe slightly a lot of their tactics during the game, he's got a kind of speed of thought again. All right, then, he's basically got plan A, plan B, plan C, plan D, and plan E. I've never known a manager be able to just, within a game, within minutes of a game, affect a change like that. And again, I'll stop here, but God almighty, as long as he's at this club, I'm going to appreciate every second we've got, because the man's a fucking genius. Yes. There's no two ways about it.
Yeah. So with the Braga game coming up, do you think he's going to make many changes? Will Shaw start, for example? I mean, if this crack about Lejeune's true about a long term injury, I mean, that's a huge blow to us, and we're going to, Shaw's just going to have to get integrated really bloody quickly. Yeah. Because I don't know about you, I don't want to start the season with Kieran Clarke. In a competitive Premier League fixture, I worry about
it. Shaw's come on tonight and played, hasn't he? So I don't see any reason why he couldn't start against Braga, put out a strong team in the first half. Play 45 minutes or maybe 60 minutes, something like that.
By the time the game comes around, Gail might have been on a
show. Yeah.
Gail might be leaving and performing.
Also, Shaw is more match fit than anyone else in that squad because he played in the World Cup.
Yeah. Does that mean he's more tired though?
I don't think we're because they're professional athletes now,
And he played like a few games.
They lost in the second round. He's a centre half, so it's not like he's a box to box midfielder. He's a Swiss international, he's got pedigree. Couldn't agree with me anymore. I love Kieran Clarke in terms of what he's given at the club, especially in the Championship season. He's clearly the kind of player who likes being at Newcastle. But you start matches in the Premier League with Kieran Clarke at centre half, then you're going to be looking around the bottom 4 or 5. No doubt. And we saw last season during the 9-game run that we had, where we collected 1 point. Clarke was a particularly weak link in that side. Shaw, I think, will adapt a lot quicker to the Premier League than he did in Spain, because playing in the Swiss Super League, playing in Germany, that the similarities they've got more in common with English football than they have with Spanish football, and I think Shaw will be fine. He'd be a fine replacement for Lejeune. And also, we mentioned it before, we're talking about him, he's got Lascelles alongside him now, and the Lascelles of this season is an established, experienced captain of a Premier League side playing at centre half. He will talk Shaw through every single minute of that game until Shaw's up to speed.
And I think Dubravka will help in that respect as well.
Yeah.
And in the wake of, a possible Harry Maguire move to Man United, and again, more talk about Lascelles possibly being a £35 million target for Leicester City. Again, I just can't see it happening. We've said before, he's not for sale, and I think especially if Lejeune's injured, they've got no chance, they could offer twice that.
And Lascelles knows we'll finish above Leicester next season, because Leicester owned up well next season, poor will be gone by Christmas. He's a good manager, but he won't. It's the style of football he plays, and we're going to have Leicester in the league table, which will probably reflect the sum of the parts of the squad. They might be 9th, 10th, 11th, 12th by Christmas. And because they won the league a couple of seasons ago, the bar with Leicester has been, it's been altered, like, kind of, like, inaccurately. It's almost like we won the league 2 seasons ago, and on a complete fluke to a certain extent, you know, like the stars aligned for them, right?
Yeah, it was.
But what happened is, they've now got an expectation level that's probably unsustainable. So Puel next season, if he hasn't got them sort of pushing top 6-7, if they're not playing this kind of, you know, attractive football, because Puel is a very pragmatic, defensive-minded coach, he'll be gone by Christmas. So Lascelles will probably look at it and go, why the fuck would I want to move to Leicester?
Yeah.
That's it.
In terms of the Braga game, Rob, do you expect us to set up fairly similarly to how we did tonight, kind of soaking up pressure, like, try to be more expansive on the break, use the pace of Perez and whoever might be playing in front of the tank? What do you expect?
Yeah, I think we'll probably put out a similar starting lineup. Maybe you might look to start Key instead of, I don't know, maybe Darmy. Try Shelby and Key together in the middle. I think Sharp probably will start. I think Braga finished fourth last season in the Primera Division, so that, you know, obviously they're a decent side, so it'll be just as difficult a test as Porto was.
I was a bit surprised that Victor Fernandez didn't come on left wing when Callum Roberts came on. That was a bit of an odd one for me, and I was trying to see from where we were, trying to see what the number on the back was. It was 37. I was thinking, I'm pretty sure from what I saw from the other games, that Victor Fernandez is 38, possibly. I might have got that one, but he was a player that is very highly rated in the under-23s. Mm. I don't know. I expected to see him, and he said he might
start against Braga.
He might get some minutes against Braga.
Atsu came on, and you know, back at Porto, because he just spent
a season there, but he didn't
do loads. I think he's very much kind of a fourth choice winger, is Atsu.
Atsu is the type of player, and we've got a few of them in the squad. Hayden, for example, they're in the no man's land between the Championship and the Premier League. They're not, they're better than the Championship, but not quite good enough for regular performances in the regular games in the Premier League, and they're kind of in that space. And like you see Atsu now, he is like, if he's a fourth choice winger, we can play him either flank, you know, we get a couple of injuries, great. Or we're chasing the game because he's got pace and he's direct. He might be very angry. He's good to bring on because he's throwing a kind of curveball at the opposition, and they might struggle to cope with it a little bit with his pace sort of 50 minutes left. But he's not a regular start in the Premier League, and hence his career so far has been relatively lower key. We got him for $6.5 million, and we got him like 24, 25. He's been on another 4 or 5 clubs. He's just an okay player.
I expect him to probably, it'll probably not last another 2 seasons. I think he'll be gone probably after the next season.
He'll probably go abroad, kind of like a more sane of mid.
I mean, it's a funny one, these pre-season friendlies, because I think we're all pretty certain that we're going to be seeing completely different strikers start up front for the first game against Spurs. I mean, Muto is expected to come in next week. Obviously, huge talk and rumours about Gale leaving, Rondon coming in in some sort of swap deal of some respect. So it's odd, because whatever we're seeing now, we still don't know how potent we can be in the final third.
I've got a question for you two, actually. This is one thing that I did notice kind of midway through the first half. And I love what this bloke's done with the club. I don't want to go anywhere. He's one of my favourite Newcastle players. Matt Ritchie, the one thing I did notice tonight, you could really tell that his lack of pace hinders him ever so slightly, because obviously Porto had so much of the ball, they were attacking so much, and a couple of times he had a chance to break, and it was Richie's intelligence, his positional play, his passing, his set pieces are all brilliant. But as a winger, just tonight, a couple of kids, I thought, oh man, if you just had that one half an extra yard of pace, it would have made a real difference. So the rumours that have gone on at the start of the summer about him getting rid of Richie perhaps and bringing someone in quicker, I can obviously see what Rafa and the coaching staff mindset is. As fans, we're very biased towards him because we love him. But at the same time, as a pragmatic manager of a football club, you probably are going, I just need someone that a little bit quicker, with that ability, with that strength, with that determination, just that half a yard. And And I noticed it. I don't know if you two did. Maybe I'm like looking a little bit too closely.
So I've thought about this, and obviously when the Townsend rumours and Richie to Stoke, that's obviously not going to happen now because Stoke have brought in two wingers. But I was sort of hopeful that Richie would move on and Townsend would come in. Obviously, I'd love the club to be in a position where they could keep Matt Richie as a backup winger, but obviously we're in a position where we're going to have to sell to buy. And you know, I did some stats on Richie and Townsend, and Richie's lack of ability to take on his man, successful dribbles, create chances. Like, Townsend is streets ahead of him in every single department. And what Townsend would bring over a Richie, we don't know, you know, Townsend might not come at all, but with Richie, a left back can read him after 10 minutes. What does he do every time? He cuts in on his left. He never goes down the outside. Someone like Townsend is versatile. He attacks in different ways. He'll cut in on his left and have a shot, or he'll go down the byline and use his right foot with his pace. And that's something Richie is never going to do. You mentioned Murphy earlier. You felt he was quite one-footed, and he kept coming on his right. He did go down and cross with his left on one occasion, and you know, there was nobody there, as it happens. I think possibly could have maybe anticipated a bit better, but I think at least Murphy's got that pace to, you know, if he is one-footed,
absolutely,
he can still get around the outside and then cut in once he's in a position, whereas Richie is never going to do that. And as much as I love what he's done for the club, as you said, I think he's been fantastic and so important for us the last two seasons. If we really want to push on, and if we want to play how Rafa sees his style of football working, we need pacey wingers. Kennedy down the left, and a pacey winger down the right, and that is not Richie, which means that we've got this. There's a bit of imbalance there. I mean, to an extent, you could argue that there's an imbalance with the Dummett's playing style and Yedlin's playing style. So actually, both sides are almost like balanced because there's a slow and a fast on each side.
Diagonally balanced.
Yeah. So, but ultimately, I think Rafa wants somebody, as you say, if you saw the frustrations there, that's something that it's a very real problem. Matt Richie turns 29 mm-hmm. next month. He's the highest value that he's ever going to be in terms of market value. I've looked up, and yeah, I think if we are going to sell to buy, I think now is the time. I mean, I can imagine there's more than just Stoke that would be interested in the services because of what he brings. You talk about Mitrovic never going to be fitting in our system, but can probably still do a reasonable job for somebody in the right system. I think Richie is better than Mitrovic and will definitely do a job in a different system that doesn't rely on pace. I think Rafa wants to high press, and that's why the likes of Muto are coming in. And if Rondon comes in, he's a bit more mobile as well. You've got Kennedy on the left. You've got Perez running in as well. He will want fast players, because if we're going to be sitting back for most, you know, if he likes to play on the counter-attack, Shelby pinging balls up, we need pace on the break, and we're out of position, we need to harry those defenders, force the mistakes and gain territory. And Richie works hard, he just doesn't have that pace that you need. And I think that's what Rafa possibly considered and might still consider letting him leave.
There's this talk about him in the dressing room as well, isn't there, about he's a little bit not disruptive, but he's not the best character in the dressing room.
Angry.
It's interesting, isn't it? Angry.
he's an angry little man. Like,
he is, isn't he? Aye.
Shouted at me once during a match.
There was a couple of times tonight, I don't know if you noticed this, he left Yedlin a little bit exposed at right back, I thought. Just a couple of times in the first half, he had two men to pick up, and they had a couple of crosses into our box as a result of that.
Well, they just got those good overlapping.
It's fair play to them, you know, that was their tactic. And it's not like Richie to neglect his defensive duties normally.
And again, because he's got that lack of pace, him getting back into position.
Potentially, definitely.
That's possibly an issue as well.
Yeah, so, yeah, we'll see what happens with him.
So, well, I think we're going to wrap that up. It's been an absolutely unbelievable experience today, and in terms of the weekend, we've spoken to loads of amazing people in Porto. They've been so friendly. There's a great atmosphere in the stadium as well. It's just been absolutely class. And so, thank you to Patreon fans for supporting us and allowing us to bring you sort of content from the front line, if you will. We really appreciate it. It's fantastic. If you're not signed up, get on board. It's £5 a month. you're going to get so many great podcasts by all the team. You know, there's a load of us that work really hard, and you know, we want to bring you more content. We want you to get involved. It's been fantastic, lads. It's been an absolute pleasure. Rafa's Mags in Porto.
Brilliant.
What an away match.
Brilliant weekend.
I just wish we were here for Braga, but there you go. Yeah.
There we go. It's not going to happen. Thanks very much, Norman. Thanks very much,
Rob. Cheers.
And we'll see you next time. Cheers.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.